Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest episode, the latest chapter, the latest great revelations from Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie-Ann Jones. Leslie-Ann, how are you this morning?
Very good, Michael. Thank you. Yes, all ticking along. It's chucking it down here. Yeah. And there might be some interruptions because we've got a scaffolding truck outside the house.
Oh, no.
Carrying planks and, you know, iron poles and goodness knows whatever else they're putting up somewhere always, down the road.
It's always a difficulty dealing with planks, I can tell you. Yes, I'm dealing with a few myself.
Present company accepted.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Yeah. Yes, okay. Well, I understand that. Weather is miserable, but it's too warm for me now. I want another cold snap. I want this blizzard to come from the east. It's great walking weather, that. And there's a big debate going on about walking at the moment, of course, Miss Jones, because there was the highlighted story last week about the two ladies who went to the Common in Derbyshire, which we already spoke about because we thought they could have been models or something like that. But now nobody knows whether walking's allowed or not and how far you can go and what's up to it. Now, have I told you that I'm talking to Julia Bradbury this weekend on my talk radio show? I can't remember if I've mentioned that yet or not.
You did mention it. She's a great girl, actually. I like her a lot.
She's a great girl. And honestly, I hope people tune in because it's not just about the fact she walks around the coastline of Devon and Cornwall. She is an absolute devotee to walking as being the absolute exercise, the one that can do more for you than any other form of exercise, better than jogging, you know, better than cycling. It's the walking. How much walking do you do, Miss Jones?
In normal circumstances, I do try to get out for a walk most days.
Yeah.
I've been a bit up against it the last few weeks because I'm trying to meet a deadline.
Sure.
And everything else goes out the window at that stage and I go mad.
Yes.
And, you know, everything is stealing time from my writing time and I've got to get the book done. And you go into this kind of panic mode.
Yes.
And so the walking is a bit on hold at the moment, but I do advocate it. I do think it's much better for you than running, especially for women, because it's very bad for your breast tissue to run. Also bad for your face. Your collagen in your face leaps up and down, gets shaken all about, and that makes you look old.
Hang on, Miss Jones. Most people have not collagen in their face.
Of course they have.
No, they haven't. Collagen stuff you pump into your lips to make your lips look more like...
No, you have natural collagen in your skin all over your body.
No, I think you've got that wrong. No.
You also get manufactured collagen. That's a whole other thing, which simulates natural collagen. But you do have collagen deposits in your face. Look it up. And especially with women, shaking that up and down if you run can loosens everything and you get that sort of hangdog look. I know quite a few women who run, you know, not professionally, but they run in marathons and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Some of them are significantly older than I am and younger, and they look older because of all this running that they do.
Oh, that's very interesting. You talk then about joggers. I mean, I'm on the point of trying to launch a campaign to ban joggers. They are so selfish, these people. I was coming back from a visit to the supermarket last night, okay? And I'm walking on a pavement and I've got a mask on and I'm trying to, you know, behave myself. This jogger went past at about, it must have been 15 miles an hour. Shot past, it quite disabled me because of the shock of this woman, actually, it was running past me. But not only that, she had her mouth wide open. She was pumping out air from her lungs like a steam locomotive. And I'm thinking, hang on, I'm in the wake of all that breath of yours that you're bursting out. They come out of nowhere. And I think they're pretty selfish sort of people.
Don't you think they ought to be using the cycle lanes in cities?
Well, use something, but don't keep running around on the pavement spreading your foul air, if it is foul air, you know, in multi-directional ways. It's just not good enough.
I've had a few conversations with people about this and they say, you're accusing me of having COVID.
Yeah.
And I say, no, I'm not, but you could potentially have it.
Exactly, none of us know.
You know, nobody knows. A lot of people are asymptomatic and spreading it. That's why the rates keep going up. And if you're a jogger, you need to be mindful of other people, the same as cyclists do, by the way.
Yes.
And you need to do all that stuff away from people who aren't doing
it. Totally agree. Go and find a field to run around or something like that. Anyway, I totally agree. Leslie Ann, I have to report the latest saga in my real problem with newspaper delivery in this part of the world, stockbroker belt, sorry. So in a previous podcast, I talked about the driver of the van that brings the papers to this part of the world. He got COVID. He was laid off. They couldn't find another one. When they did, he lost direction and route, and the papers were turning up at 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning. Anyway, they found a new driver. I thought, wow, this is great. So it's all going to get back to normal earlier this week. Guess what happens? Poor old newspaper boy crashes into a car and breaks his jaw. And he had to be carted off to hospital.
Oh, no. That's awful. Poor little boy.
Well, actually, it's funny you should say that. He's not a little boy. He's about 22 or 23. And I gave him 40 quid at Christmas because I didn't realise he's the father of two. But he's still the newspaper boy.
A father of two at 22, that's scary, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But I see a lot of people who deliver newspapers these days being way above the age range of what newspaper boys were when I was a newspaper boy. I was, by the way, the best newspaper boy in Chester, my hometown. I mean, I was champion. Nobody could beat me, honest to God. I was the very best. I loved it. Loved getting up in the morning, going out there on my bike, getting my papers slung across my back, delivering them all. And then I was usually back. I was always back first because I was so good and so fast, you know, had the fastest bike and all that kind of stuff. Then I'd get a second round and go out and do all those. On a Friday, when the local newspapers came out, Chester Chronicle and the Cheshire Observer, and I ended up going to work for the Chester Chronicle as a cub reporter, I would do three or four rounds a day. And the weight of those papers on your back, I must have been very fit in those days.
So what did you do this before school?
I was only allowed to do it by my mum and dad in the holidays. So I did it all over summer, did it at winter and Easter. But nevertheless, when I got in there, I was welcome with open arms. I was so good, so reliable, so efficient, so fast, just about, you know, the greatest newspaper delivery boy there's ever been, I think.
I don't doubt it. But do you think that's the genesis of your newspaper career? Do you think that's what made you interested in papers in the first place?
I absolutely loved the smell of the ink, because in those days the papers would arrive, the ink would still be wet, if you know what I mean. You've got terrible amounts of ink on your fingers and everything. But I loved the smell of the ink. I loved the content of newspapers. I was a huge football fan, so I wanted to read the back page of every newspaper as I was delivering my papers and all that. And then I'd always take a couple of papers home because it definitely gave me the appetite for newspapers and wanting to read them and see what was in them and all that kind of stuff, you know. So I think you're absolutely right. Yeah, I think you did.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I mean, it was quite a dangerous pursuit. There were a few murders of newspaper boys, weren't there? Do you remember that Carl Bridgewater?
I was about
murder.
To say to you, I just started working for the Birmingham Mail when the Carl Bridgewater newspaper boy murder happened, and it was the biggest story in the Midlands for many a year. Just to sum it up, Carl Bridgewater was a little lad who was delivering newspapers in the West Midlands, in the Black Country, I think, King's Winford or somewhere like that.
And Stourbridge it was.
Stourbridge, yeah, that's the same sort of area. You're absolutely right, Stourbridge. And he went to a farmhouse to deliver a paper. The farmhouse was being burgled at the time and he was shot dead with a shotgun. It was an horrendous crime.
And they got the guy. I think somebody went to prison for it, didn't they?
They got three guys, right? It was really interesting. They went to prison, but then for years afterwards, there was always doubt about their convictions. It was, in the same part of the world, remember, for 13 years, the campaign against the Birmingham Six was launched because, you know, they eventually got released after 13 years in jail. They were found innocent on appeal. And the same thing was happening with the Carl Bridgewater killers. They're all dead now, but they all went to jail, but they all blamed each other. It was never, ever clear who actually, you know, pulled the trigger on the shotgun that killed poor little Carl.
Mm. My mother never allowed me to do a paper round. I had other Saturday jobs and things, but, you know, not paper. I think it's quite a dangerous thing to do.
Well, it was dangerous when you were, you know, scooting around on your bike all the time because you're so anxious to get to your next house and get across the road. It was definitely, there was an element of danger there. But quite a lot of girls worked at the newspaper shop I worked at. The newspaper shop I worked at was called Docker Dawson's because he was a local businessman. He had the newspaper shop, he had the dry cleaners and all that kind of stuff, you know, and a grubby little man. But I loved it, and it gave me my first sense of independence because, of course, I was earning my own money. So, you know, it was great. But anyway, there we are. Now, we don't usually go a podcast without relating something towards John Lennon or the Beatles, so we mustn't let our listeners down. I saw an amazing thing because I'm, you know, on all the Beatles sort of Twitter accounts. The song Because is the only Beatles song on which three of the Beatles, that being John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, harmonised on the song together. The only time the three of them harmonised together.
That's interesting. Yeah, I suppose most of it was John and Paul, wasn't it?
Yeah. I'll give you a rendition of Because it's so beautiful. Because the world is round, it turns me on. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think they should sign you up, maybe. Yeah, well, I do. Pretty good.
Yeah, but what I was going to say is, the other interesting thing about that, and I read this in a Lennon interview years ago, is that he said to, they were, John and Yoko were listening to Moonlight Sonata. You probably know this story. And
yes,
John was
Beethoven,
like,
yeah, she plays it. Yoko plays it.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, okay, thank you. That's even better. So she's playing it on his white piano. He's lying on the couch. He then suddenly says to her, this is where true genius comes from, play those chords backwards. And from that, he wrote that song I've just sung you, Because. I mean, that is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very interesting, yeah. But I think people underestimated Yoko. She was quite a musician in her own right.
Yes.
I had a lot of time for Linda McCartney, but she was no musician. And, of course, post-Beatles, Paul decides he wants his wife to be with him at all times, even on the road, playing in the band. So he teaches her a few chords on the keyboards, and away they go. She's part of Wings.
Yeah.
Whereas Yoko, people castigated her for trying to sing and perform with John.
Yes.
She was actually a real musician.
Yeah, I know. And she did contribute to Imagine, because most of the lyrics were hers from that little book she wrote. What was it called? Grapefruit or something?
Yes, exactly. And that was only acknowledged years later. And John was quite embarrassed about it in the end because he was enlightened by this time. Yeah. And he said, you know, just because she was the wife, she was the one at home, I didn't think to acknowledge her, to give her any credit. But of course, she was the genesis of that song.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. Now, have you been watching Janet Street Porter lately, Miss Jones?
I try not to whenever I can help it, because she gets on my tits.
Yeah, that's a brilliant impersonation. That, well done, Leslie Ann. But anyway, as we discussed before we got round to recording this podcast, you and Janet Street Porter have got more in common than you think, because I flicked on the telly the other morning, right? Most in the morning, I'm either in the kitchen and I've got telly on in there, or I'm in my office and I've got the telly on in there, okay? But sort of mid-morning when I'd finished doing all the, you know, early work and all that, I went into my lounge, switched the telly on, and there was Loose Women, which I must admit I haven't watched for years. I find it a very woman programme, if you know what I mean. I can't really relate to it.
I can't stand it, to be honest with you. No, I really can't. It winds me up. I feel that gives women a bad name.
Well, I thought it'd be very interesting for women because I thought the age of the ladette had all gone, you know, with Zoe Ball and all that kind of stuff. But there's an awful lot of that still about it. Isn't it?
Yeah, there is. It's all a bit low rent for me, I'm afraid. Sorry to sound like a snob.
I agree with you. But anyway, Ms. Street Porter was having a row with some of the other panellists about whether or not you should let your daughter go to influencer school, i.e., you know, that's now become a profession in the eyes of some people. You earn your living by smiling and putting your pictures out on Snapchat or whatever, you know. And I have to say, Miss Street Porter was totally against it and said, if I had a daughter, I don't think she's got any children, has she? But if I had a daughter, I wouldn't let her go to influencer school. I'd send her off to a class to become a potter or a plumber. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I totally agree with her, which I hesitate to say. Yeah. But of course, a proper vocation, doing any kind of job that you will always find employment.
Yeah.
As you know, my kids are musical. And
absolutely.
I said to my son when he was a little boy, stick at your piano lessons, because if all else fails, you can go and tinkle a few tunes in a hotel bar somewhere and earn a living that way night after night. You know, if you've got instrumental ability, you will always find employment. The same as if you're a plumber or a gardener, even, whatever.
Yeah.
But influencing school, forget that. That's just pie in the sky.
I totally agree with you. If you learn how to play the piano, it's the old Elton John thing, isn't it? Don't shoot me, I'm just the piano player. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's absolutely right. Yeah, you see, I don't know why you're so against influencing, because, I mean, some women have made themselves literally billionaires from being an influencer. So if it's got a track record of success and can bring people great wealth because they want to cash in on their good looks and their persona and their style, surely that's to be commended, isn't it?
Well, yes and no. I mean, a lot of this is selling a product to very impressionable kids who don't know any better.
Well, isn't isn't that just like Walker's selling crisps to kids, or any chocolate company selling chocolate bars?
I guess it is in a way, but I'm thinking of this particular Kardashian kid, and I've never seen the Kardashians, so I don't really know what it's all about, but I think it's coming off now, isn't it? But there's one that has a line of makeup and beauty products, and she's made more money than all politicians put together out of this range of makeup, all of which is selling to impressionable young girls who can't really afford it. Yeah. And it's giving them the impression that their faces are only pretty and valuable if they're caked in all this gunk that this particular, is it Chloe? Maybe it's Chloe Kardashian that she's selling. I think it promotes the wrong morals and the wrong values in life. Really my problem with it.
I admire anybody who's successful and in whatever, you know, route they take or whatever, but you know, I can see what you mean there. And also it's a bit, you know, like being an apprentice footballer. Only about 1 in 10,000 ever quite make it, and then the dreams and the hopes of the rest are shattered. I bet there's millions of little girls around the world who dream of being an influencer, but they'll never get there.
No, it's like millions dream of being models, isn't it? It's funny you should say about footballers. One of my son's closest friends was considered the top footballer in the school and was going to be, you know, a big star at one of the Premier League clubs and so on. Yeah. That dream has faded away, and he was brilliant. He was by far the best of all the kids we knew. And you think, well, yeah, how many of him are out there?
Yeah.
Oh, as you say, their dreams are dashed.
Oh, they're totally dashed. I did a lot of work with Joe Cole, the very successful Chelsea and England footballer, okay? Joe won 3 Premier League titles, 3 FA Cups. And, you know, Joe never forgot how fortunate he was to have got through and made it right to the top. And he saw like thousands of kids, you know, just fall out of the reckoning along the way. You had to be very resilient and very talented to get to the end. One story he told me, by the way, was, you know, Joe was a star from the age of about 10 or 11. He was always the best footballer in the team, you know. And he told me about the pressure parents put on their kids. And Joe was an attacking winger in those days. And he was playing on the right side, and he was absolutely roasting the opposition fullback. This is when they were about 13 or 14, you know what I mean? And the opposition fullback's father was standing on the touchline, and he was screaming and bellowing at his kid, "Don't let that bastard get past you again, break his legs," you know, and all this kind of stuff. And this kid started crying because his father was giving him so much stick. So Joe, because he's a very nice guy, just went up to the fullback and said, "Don't worry, mate, I'll go on the other side." And Joe went and played on the other side so that he wasn't roasting this fullback anymore. It's a nice thing to do, isn't it?
Lovely story. But don't you think a lot of it is driven by very ambitious parents
who
didn't fulfil their own dreams and they're now trying to live vicariously through their children?
Yes. Oh, definitely. Absolutely. I think there was a bit of that in my father. You know, he claims that his education was destroyed by the war because he left school at 17 and joined the Royal Navy in 1940. So he never completed his education. Now, you know, obviously you feel for your parents and all that, but I'm afraid millions and millions of people suffered that. And we're not suffering like that today in the pandemic, but millions of people have had their lives changed. But I think my father was very bitter that he never fulfilled his education. And without a shadow of doubt, he always had huge ambitions for me at school, you know, always pushing me, you know, "You've got to get more O-levels, more L's. I want you to go to Oxford or Cambridge, you know, don't let the family down." Yeah, tremendous pressure. And in the end, it turned me completely against it. I got fed up of reading books. And once I discovered beer and women, when I got into the sixth form, it was all over for me anyway.
I remember taking a lot of stick from my son's school, other parents actually, because he was on track to go to Exeter University, read law with Spanish, and become a lawyer of some kind. And, you know, he had that sort of moment of realization when I took them to see the Rocky Horror Show one night. I'm going to do that, Mummy. Yes. What do you mean you're going to do that? I'm going to be Frankenfurter. I'm going to be a musical theater star.
Right.
And other parents were saying to me, why did you let him do this? I said, what do you mean let him?
Yeah.
I can't influence him in any way. He will do what he wants to do. He's had the benefit of a great education. If he then chooses to take that path, I have to support that. Yeah. Because if you force a child down any route that is not at their heart, what they really want to do, then they're going to drop out eventually anyway, and it's all going to go off the side.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I failed my A-levels and ended up going to the University of the Trent to do urban estate management because my old fella by that time had become a property agent. You know, he used to move on to building sites and sell houses and that kind of stuff. So his great ambition then was we're going to set up an estate agency. So if you go off and get yourself a certificate to say you're a chartered surveyor, we're in business. But that lasted half a year. And then I just gave up and played snooker and darts for the rest of that year. And then the moment of revelation, came back to Chester where I lived, walked into the Chester Chronicle and somehow managed to get a job as a reporter. When they turned down 30 or 40 people that year, it was amazing. Just a stroke of luck, right place, right time. And the rest is history, Miss Jones. Did you ever have much to do with Mel C?
No, the Spice Girls were happening when I got married in 96, and I was having babies, sort of popping them out. And so I was off the road by that time.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
I mean, I was aware of the Spice Girls. They would crop up on television and so on, but I never had anything to do with them professionally. No,
that was more Piers Morgan's bag, wasn't it? I think it was. Yeah, I saw Piers Morgan take that and Spice Girls. Mm-hmm. No, the only reason I mention it is that Mel C's 47. I always regarded her as the most grounded of the lot of them, you know. I thought Jerry and Scary Spice were both a bit sort of ambitiously mad. And Posh, of course, wanted to, you know, be something else. Baby was, I think, just a sort of, I don't know, almost in the shadows of all the rest of them. But I always thought that Mel C was grounded. She's apparently the most talented of them, but she's 47 anyway, and reveals in an interview that towards the end, they all disliked each other so much because of all the, you know, the anguish in the group, that they recorded the tracks individually and then the tape was sent in and then put together by an engineer. I didn't know you could do that.
Well, I mean, this was where recording was heading anyway. And it's very common now that tracks are electronically assembled after they've been recorded, sort of separate parts. Do you remember that famous, it was really massive at the time, 1993 when it came up, Frank Sinatra's Duets album?
I don't, but I'm aware that it happened. Yeah, yeah.
So he recorded with people like Bono, Aretha Franklin, Pavarotti, Willie Nelson. None of them ever was in the studio with him. Even in 1993, that was happening.
Right.
So I doubt that it was to do with they were not getting on at the time, as much as it was much easier because technology was heading that way.
Yeah.
It's much easier to control a single vocal than it is to record everybody at once around a microphone because you can manipulate the recordings.
But suppose they're not singing at the same speed.
Well, they can fix all that. I mean, supposing you're not. Hello.
Yeah.
Oh, someone got a cross line there. Somebody else has joined in.
Very popular. Yeah.
A lot of people sing out of tune, for example, and they can fix all of that with auto tune and everything else.
Golly.
It's much easier to fix a single vocal. So I suggest that may have had something to do with it, rather than they were all not speaking at the time.
You could well be right. Right, okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for joining us. I am Mike Parry, the Portmeister, and of course, Miss Jones is with me. Miss Jones, I'm just going to take a few seconds to plug my radio shows for the forthcoming weekend. I'll be doing talk radio on Saturday 5 to 7 and Sunday 1 till 4. And may I thank you publicly, Miss Jones, for your appearance on that Sunday show last week, when, of course, you got stuck into another subject of which you are master, and that is David Bowie.
That was very nice to be on, and nice of you to invite me. Of course, we had two big anniversaries. It was 5 years since Bowie's birthday and 5 years since he died. And, of course, all the controversy arises again as to whether he took his own life because he'd been away for a long time. Then his album Black Star came out, and then 2 days later he died. So the timing all seemed a little bit too coincidental for some people who were determined to suggest that he may have killed himself.
Shocking, and the loss of a great, great life. Now, Ms. Jones, we've both worked in the newspaper business for most of our lives. I mean, we're not in it now, but we're still attached to it, and it was the grounding of us. I read a fantastic obit in the Daily Telegraph about a legendary American journalist called Neil Sheehan, OK? And, I mean, he's almost on the sort of... who were the two guys who wrote the All the President's Men?
Woodward and Bernstein.
Woodward and Bernstein. He's almost on that level because what this guy did is he got hold of what's called the Pentagon Papers. And the Pentagon Papers, don't get long and boring about past wars and all that, but the Pentagon Papers revealed atrocities committed by the American military in the Vietnam War, okay? And this guy managed to, you know, get the confidence of some politician in America who released these papers to him. He was given a couple of hours with these papers, 7,000 documents. And by organising a team of helpers, he managed to get every single document of 7,000 photocopied overnight in a couple of hours. So he had all the evidence when it came to the Senate hearing. Then he broke the story in the New York Times and he became a legend. But I have to say, I do love stories like that about, you know, the ins and outs of breaking huge exclusives.
It was interesting because he duped the guy who leaked him the papers. It was a consultant in the Defense Department.
Right.
And he allowed him to see the documents, but not to take them away. And so, of course, he did organize this photocopying session.
Yes.
But then because he'd copied them illicitly and then they were published in the Times or some of them anyway, the Nixon administration stopped publication.
Yeah.
But the Times did go on to win a Pulitzer Prize for public service because it exposed dastardly goings-on.
Yeah.
And it also showed another example of what a snake Nixon was, I think.
Well, you see, I couldn't quite... When I read the whole thing, I couldn't understand why Nixon got upset because all the atrocities took place during the Kennedy Johnson, Lyndon Baines Johnson era. But Nixon, you know, came up with the, you know, the supremacy of the presidency and all this kind of stuff. You know, American journalists, by the way, I mean, I'm not knocking this guy, brilliant coup and all that kind of stuff, James Coup. But they don't often take themselves seriously, you know.
Goodness, tell me about it. I mean, I've had drinks and dinner with a few of them over the years, and they really are quite pompous sometimes. He did a book, this guy, Neil Sheehan. Do you remember the book, A Bright Shining Lie, which I thought was a wonderful title?
Yeah.
And it took him 15 years to write.
Right, blimey. What was that? Was that about his coup, about Pentagon Papers?
Yeah, the whole sort of deception at the heart of the Vietnam War.
Sure.
It was published in 1988, so just around the time when we were in our Fleet Street heyday, so it was quite big news.
Yeah.
But I thought, part of me thought the luxury of having 15 years to write a book, you know.
Exactly,
I don't even get a year, mostly.
You get about 15 weeks, don't you?
Yeah.
And then, then you're 24 hours a day to crack a deadline. I once, when I was leaving one job, going to another, it was before the days of sort of mass computerization, I decided I had to steal the office contacts book, you know, so that I would have a load of great numbers to take to my new job. And of course, I had to bribe a secretary, you know, with certain favours, you know what I mean? Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. It's a family show, come on.
A family show, that's absolutely right, yeah. And I got it, and she photocopied it for me, all of it. So that was
your Pentagon Papers.
That was my Pentagon Papers, definitely, yeah. But I'll tell you a story about an American journalist. I spent quite a lot of time in, they take themselves very seriously, but they have very strange values. So I spent about 18 months in Northern Ireland when I was on the Daily Express in Manchester, right? And it was, you know, an incredible period. It was from the start of the hunger strikes to the end of the hunger strikes. It was quite amazing. But this American journalist came over, and American journalism is totally pro-Republican and anti the UK government. It always has been. because of the ancestry of a lot of Americans, you know, on particularly on the East Coast, Boston and New York, Philadelphia and all that kind of stuff. And this guy from, I can't remember which paper he was from now. I think it might have been the New York Daily News, but I'm not rubbishing the title if it wasn't. He wrote this incredible piece, 5 pages long, about being in the back of an Army Land Rover coming out of one of the Army barracks one morning and patrolling the streets of Belfast and detailing all sorts of atrocities, like, you know, firing rubber bullets at children and setting fire to homes of, you know, known IRA sympathisers. It was so ludicrous that it wouldn't have sat right in a novel. But this newspaper published it. And then Sir David English, who I'm sure you will have worked for, won't you?
Yes, he was my boss at the Daily Mail.
That's what I mean. Yeah, he was the editor then. He just sent, a whole new team arrived in town and they went through this guy's account line by line. And every single word of it was utter rubbish. You know, he made it all up. He mocked and disgraced the British Army and the British government. And that's the sort of thing the Americans do. And, they pride themselves on their journalism because it's always so accurate, but they're always pulling off tricks like that.
Well, it's not accurate if they're making it up, is it?
No, exactly. It was, but anyway.
We're not saying that all American journalists make up their stories, just to clarify that.
No, of course not. No, and of course not saying that. What I'm saying is there have been several cases of that. There was a case just 2 or 3 years ago of some bloke who was hailed as a genius young journalist, Pulitzer Prize and all that. He made up all his stories. It's quite legendary. It's very competitive business over there.
Are you talking about Mia Farrow's son, Ronan?
I could be. Oh, no. He actually exposed some real sexual demeanour cases, didn't he?
Own family, but there was...
He uncovered Harvey Weinstein, didn't he?
I think he did have something to do with
that. He did.
I think he won a Pulitzer Prize.
But he was totally straight. Everything he wrote was justified in the end.
There is some scandal attached to his name, and I can't remember what it is. Well, I'll have to look it up.
Well, you're also talking, of course, about Woody Allen and the allegations made against him. And he also...
Well, Woody Allen's his father.
Is it his father or stepfather?
Yes, it's his father.
Father, okay. Well, there we go. Yes, I think there's enough of that, Miss Jones. As you say, it's a family show. Now, have you ever had any dealings with Suggs?
Yeah, used to know him pretty well. What a great guy. I never understood why he was called Suggs, because his name is Graham.
Yes.
But where does Suggs come from? Is it one of those names that, you know, like if your name is White, they always call you Chalky?
Yes, or something that's right,
like
that.
It must mean something that we don't know.
Well, I'm sure I've read it over the years, but I've forgotten, you know, because anyway, the reason is he's 60, OK, his birthday, 60. And he looks a very young 60 to me. So last time I saw him on telly, he looked about sort of 40 or 45. But I agree with you. I've only met him once. I think he's a Chelsea fan. Right. And I think we talked football and he's a very nice chap. They were quite a phenomenon, that group of his, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. They sort of revived ska in their way. You know, ska was the big Jamaican musical style and they brought that back. But I remember him saying a long time ago, the reason behind their success was that they gave boys an excuse to dance again.
Right.
Because the opportunities for boys to dance had gone out the window once ballroom dancing moved on and all that kind of thing, long before Strictly brought it all back.
Yes.
And boys going to discos didn't really dance because it was a bit daft, you know, it was a bit silly. And the girls would all go in the middle of the dance floor, they'd dance around their handbags, which were all in a pile in the middle. And
there
wasn't really a place for boys to join in. So what Madness did for boys was to bring back this, let's all make fun of ourselves, let's send ourselves up and let's leap around the dance floor as if we're all drunk, sometimes with a pint in their hand and stuff. And they just went a bit daft. And I think it was a breath of fresh air at the time.
I couldn't work out whether I liked their music or not. I didn't know it was called ska, by the way. It was just, to me, a bit different, you know, Madness, you know.
The rhythm and the groove of it is all ska based.
If you look at us in the middle of our street, house and all that kind of stuff, you know. Welcome to the, what was it? Welcome to
house
the house
of fun. Baggy trousers was my favourite.
Baggy trousers, yeah. Yeah, well, I totally agree.
I think I thought, the first time I heard that, I thought it was called baguette trousers, baguette, as in the French trousers. Bread. And I kept hearing baguette trousers, and I don't know why. Mm. Must have been drunk that week. But
must have been, yeah. A regular
friend
appearance.
Of mine, Annabelle Lord, she produced a musical for Madness called Our House. It was brilliant. Went along to see that and thought, wow, this is really going to go places. But it died a death very quickly.
Died a death. Well, there you go. Now, talking about friends, you said she was a friend of yours, your friend Liz Jones. Now, in our last podcast, we were just talking about the relative merits of high heels for ladies and trainers, right? And of course, I'm a huge fan of high heels, and you said they're very painful and all that. And your friend Ms. Jones, Liz Jones, a columnist from You Magazine, which is the pull-out magazine from the Mail on Sunday, she wrote a whole 2 or 3 page spread on the new fashion being trainers, some of which cost up to £7,000. I mean, you know, this is getting really serious now, isn't it?
Well, I know. And I had a look back through her archives, actually, through her columns, to see what else she had said about trainers.
Yes.
And back in 2013... she was having a go at Beyoncé in print for these trainers that were made of the skin of stingray, anacondas, ostrich, crocodile, and calf, all in one shoe. And she said how medieval and grotesque that was. Yes. And she also said that trainers look like moon boots, and they make they're made for people, I should say, with more money than taste or morals.
Right.
So she seems to have done a volte-face on her opinion.
Well, either a vault fast, or when she was offered a couple of grand to write the feature, you write it, don't you? And it's kind
how
of money
cynical you are, Michael.
Well, you know, I'm sorry, there is a cynic in me. I mean, to be honest, that's the only thing I wear now, trainers, because I find them so comfortable, and I do a lot of walking, and so I wear a pair of trainers as smart shoes until they get a bit shabby, and then they become my walking shoes, if you see what I mean. But of course, I have still got shoes with leather and heels on them for when I'm doing proper jobs, like maybe the Jeremy Vine show, going into the studio. Of course, you don't need to wear any shoes when you're doing a TV show from home, because people only see the top half of you. And so you can wear, you know, a shirt and a jacket and a pair of football shorts. And you certainly don't need your trainers on.
Is that
on.
What you wear? So what colour are your football shorts?
Blue.
Oh, I'd like sort of neon pink.
No, you know, no.
I'd like
good
to picture you in sort of fur-lined, striped. Do you wear slippers?
Well, I wear something more akin to flip-flops, actually, because slippers, I believe, are a domestic form of footwear, and I don't like to feel domestic if I'm actually working, if you see what I mean.
I think that's true. I think what you have on your feet, even though you can only be seen from the waist up, it's a bit like sometimes when I get stuck, if I'm writing and I get a bit of writer's block sometimes.
Yes.
What do I want to say here? If I can't think of anything to say,
yes,
I put red lipstick on. I never, when did you ever see me wear red lipstick in
not
real
very
life?
Very often, I have to say.
I never wear it. Never wear it.
You don't put lipstick on, and what effect does that have?
It makes me feel more professional.
Oh, I
and
see.
Sometimes I come up with the goods. I think it's a bit like, do you remember that phenomenon in the 80s for wearing big wide shoulder pads, women, I mean.
Yeah, well, we discussed Joan Collins, haven't we, in Dynasty and all that, yeah.
So the more, the wider the shoulder pads got, the more powerful you felt. So you're a bit like a superhero, you know, with big padded, like the American footballers and so on. And you kid your brain into thinking that you're more capable than you are, and you rise to the occasion. So I think that's what the red lipstick is doing for me.
Well, that's great psychology. I didn't realise that. But I mean, I've got to feel right when I'm in a job. I don't mind dressing very casually now doing a radio show. I really don't, you know. It makes you feel more at ease and you look like the people around you. But in my newspaper days, I insisted that, you know, not only I wore a suit and a tie and a shirt, but everybody else that was working within my department did, you know, because I really felt that that was that there was a need for it. I actually sent a young lady home once because her skirt was too short.
Yeah. I thought you would have asked her to turn it up a bit.
you see, once again, maligning my character, Miss Jo, you know, making out some sort of, you know, middle-aged perv, you know. And,
you weren't middle-aged in those days. But I think as well, you know, when we were reporters, especially, there was the thing, it used to be a rule in the Mail office anyway, that you had to look as though you could go to a wedding, a funeral, or to the palace to see the Queen. Yeah. So you always had to dress smartly. You never knew what story you might be sent on next.
No, I totally agree. That was it. But also, I like to see people around the office looking smart, you know what I mean? Because it made the place feel better. It wasn't so bad when we were in the building in Fleet Street. That building was falling to bits, called the Black Lubyanka. It was the original newspaper office built by Lord Beaverbrook, a fantastic architectural development. And it's a listed building these days. It really is a black glass palace, you know, on Fleet Street. But inside, my God, there was no air conditioning. The windows were cracked and broken. The desks were falling to pieces. The central heating had broken down. It was a shocker. And you didn't dare wear really nice clothes because the place was crawling with sort of, you know, what do they call those little flies, you know, fruit flies, something. Yeah, fruit
oh,
flies.
Oh, God, horrible. Yeah, must have been an infestation of some kind.
Oh, that's right. Mice running all over the place. Honestly, it was disturbing. So you didn't really feel like you wanted to wear decent clothes there. But then when we got to the new newspaper offices on the south side of Blackfriars Bridge, I mean, it was like moving into a 5-star hotel. And that made everybody, that improved everybody's appearance. And in doing that, you know, it improved everybody's performance because they felt there was something worth working for then in these glorious new offices, you know?
Yeah, well, it's the same psychology as the red lipstick, isn't it?
I suppose it is.
The red lipstick effect.
Yes, the red lipstick effect. I totally agree with you. Talking about that, by the way, Fiona Bruce is a member of our clan. She's a media person, journalist and all that. I saw her talking just recently about sometimes during the course of her career as a news reader, she didn't mention herself, but she said she's seen other colleagues who had to have sort of counselling after covering a particularly distressing story. And I've never come across that in my business. Have you?
Yes, definitely. I mean, not only you read Andy Peebles, who did the last interview with John Lennon, who we've mentioned in our podcast, but his point was the BBC never offered him counselling for what he'd gone through. And to this day, 40 years later, he feels hard done by about that and he should have had help. But I covered a story in South Dakota years ago during the 90s.
Yeah.
There was a guy called John Thompson. He was a young guy. He was still at school. He lived on a farm in South Dakota and his parents were off, I don't know, picking up supplies or whatever.
Right.
He'd gone down the farm into the barn where the threshing machine was and somehow or another fell in to the threshing machine. His arms.
Oh, his arms, God.
Both his arms were torn off. Yeah. He somehow managed to crawl back the half mile to the farmhouse building.
Yeah.
He managed to switch on the taps of the bath with his mouth.
Yeah.
And he ran a cold bath and got in so that he could stem the flow of the bleeding.
Yeah.
And he also managed somehow with his mouth to dial 911. And called the ambulance to come and deal with it because living where they were, it was very remote.
Yeah.
And it took the ambulance over an hour to get there. But had he not had the forethought to run the bath and get in, he would have died. But that really affected me, that story, for a long, long time. I was really upset every time I thought about him.
Yes. And so did you get any treatment for it?
No. Because there wasn't any of that in those days.
No, that's what I mean.
There?
Yeah. No, there wasn't. I remember a similar story to that, but a young lad who went into the grain silo when it got stuck. Then it started again. He got sucked down. It took both his legs off.
Oh,
you know.
Geez.
Yeah, what I mean? As it gets into the, like, it was like a funnel, you know what I mean? Before they stopped the machine. And like you, I sometimes think of these things and it's a flashback and I think that's horrible. When I was in Libya once, after the Americans had bombed it, Gaddafi's henchmen made us all get into a truck and toured us around the, you know, the smoking remains of the bomb sites. And what they'd done is, they'd gone and got bodies from the local mortuary and they'd thrown the bodies onto the rubble so that Western reporters being taken around were going to report about all these casualties, you know. But in fact, they weren't casualties of the bombing. They were literally dead people who'd been brought out of mortuaries, and things like that really get you. You don't really want to think back on it all, you know.
What a disgusting thing to do.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Absolutely. Well, we kind of knew right away because some of them were still frozen. I know that sounds, you know, sort of like a bit of black humour and all that, but that is the case, believe me. Anyway,
that's
let's finish.
A horrible thing to have to look back on.
Sorry. Yeah, I know. Yeah, it was. Yeah, and some of the tortures that were carried out on.
No, family shit.
Libya. No, I totally agree. You don't like to think about it, do you? Let's finish on a much happier and higher note. Danny Boyle, who is a legendary sort of film producer and director and all that, is going to make a biopic about the Sex Pistols. The Sex Pistols weren't around for very long, Miss Jones, but my God, they made a mark on British society, didn't they?
What a band they were as well. But I'm a bit confused about this because the film's already been done. It was called The Great Rock and Roll Swindle.
Right.
And it came out in 1980. It's one of the great rock and roll films. Julian Temple directed it, and it focused heavily on Malcolm McLaren, of course, because everything about the Sex Pistols was about Malcolm McLaren.
Yeah.
But what a great soundtrack. And I love Danny Boyle, but this one's been done, mate.
Well, so it's now a drama series about them. That's the Sex Pistols. It's being directed by Danny Boyle, whose credits include Trainspotting and Slumdog Millionaire. Pistol is based on Lonely Boy, Tales from a Sex Pistol, a 2018 memoir by guitarist Steve Jones.
Okay.
Yeah,
but I always thought Glenn Matlock was the most interesting one in that band. He still is. Great musician. I've seen him live a few times. And there was an impression around at the time as well that they were just a flung together sort of fake band who were just there to cause havoc and to get publicity.
Yes.
But actually, they were great musicians. Yeah. And if you listen to any of the Sex Pistols singles now, I think you'll find they were much more musical than you remember.
Well, I don't know why. I had one of their LPs. I think it was them, or it might have been another group. But there was a song called 5 Minutes and We're Almost There. And it was a brilliant single. It was on one of their LPs. 5 Minutes and We're Almost There. But it was
Was that them? Was that them?
I don't know. Sure. I can't remember. I can't think why I'd have a Sex Pistols LP, to be honest. But of course,
yeah, me neither.
No, exactly. That's right. But the most shocking story about the Sex Pistols was the way that Sid Vicious and Nancy Spungen died, wasn't it?
Sid and Nancy, that was a whole other film, wasn't it? But
the Chelsea Hotel, wasn't it?
That was, and he killed her. He stabbed her.
He killed her in an induced drug, you know, coma or haze or something. They locked him up for it, and then he took his own life in jail.
Yeah, well, he got arrested for something else. He attacked some musicians. Might have been Chrissy Hynde's brother.
Right.
In a club.
Right.
And he got locked up for that. And he was in Sing Sing, I think.
Yeah, Sing Sing, that's right. Yeah,
I think he was. Famous prison, and he killed himself in there.
Yeah, well, very odd. But it was shortened tumultuous life. Just to finish on that, I wrote a song to promote a tour we were doing when I was in an act called The Two Mics, right? And I was asked to write it by this producer promoter guy in Soho. And I went down to this little club in Soho to see him, and I'd written a song. He said, "That's great." He said, "I've got a musician who's going to put music to it." He said, "And Johnny Rotten's going to sing it. He's a big fan of yours." And I said, "Sorry, what do you mean? Johnny Rotten is a big fan of mine." He said, "Oh, yeah, he's listened to your late night radio show. He stays up all night. He's a big fan. And I've known him for years, and I've asked him, and he's going to sing. You know, we're going to get a couple of musicians together, put music to this, and Johnny Rotten's going to sing it." I said, "Well, that's brilliant. Thank you." And about 3 days later, this chap I was talking to in this little club underneath a theatre in Soho, and I can't remember what the theatre's called, she sent me an email saying, "I'm awfully sorry, but Rod," that was the name of the bloke, "died in his sleep last night."
No.
Yes.
Oh, no.
Yes.
So just near yet so far.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, that was the end of that one. But anyway, there we are.
Well, what you should have done was get in touch with John Lydon yourself and still record the single in tribute to Rod.
Well, all of that could have happened, except that, you know, so much is going on in life, it just leaves you behind, doesn't it? You know, somebody else was looking after this project, and I thought, that'll just happen. Then he didn't. I couldn't be bothered to sort of chase it up, really. But anyway, there we are. So there we are, Miss Jones, the end of another chapter of Life on Planet Porky. Can I say congratulations, getting right near to the end of your absolutely frantic deadline race to get your words finished. And what will we be looking forward to when that comes out?
So this is a new study of Freddie Mercury. It's to do with the major relationships in his life and delving a bit deeper into the psychology behind the kind of relationships he pursued to, you know, have another look at what kind of guy he was.
Brilliant. That's terrific. I'll expect to see that in the best-selling charts next year. Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed. Remember, COVID is everywhere. Stay safe, please. Self-isolate. Look after yourself. But more importantly, look after everybody else.
See you soon.
Nobody could beat me. Honest to God, I was the very best. I loved it. Loved getting up in the morning, going out there on my bike, getting my papers slung across my back, delivering them all. And then I was always back first because I was so good and so fast, you know, had the fastest bike and all that kind of stuff. Then I'd get a second round and go out and do all those. On a Friday, when the local newspapers came out, Chester Chronicle and the Cheshire Observer, and I ended up going to work for the Chester Chronicle as a cub reporter, I would do three or four rounds a day. And the weight of those papers on your back, I must have been very fit in those days.
So what did you do this before school?
I was only allowed to do it by my mum and dad in the holidays. So I did it all over summer, did it at winter and Easter. But nevertheless, when I got in there, I was welcome with open arms. I was so good, so reliable, so efficient, so fast. Just about, you know, the greatest newspaper delivery boy there's ever been, I think. Actually sent a young lady home once because her skirt was too short.
Yeah. I thought you would have asked her to turn it up a bit.
See, once again, maligning my character, Miss Jo. You know, making that some sort of, you know, middle-aged perv, you know.
You weren't middle-aged in those days.
I mean, I'm on the point of trying to launch a campaign to ban joggers. They are so selfish, these people.